a Machine Music Podcast.
Welcome back to Matechet, a Machine Music Podcast. The audible accompaniment to machinemusic.net. Happy you can join me if you're returning, unbelievably. Hi. My name is Ron Ben-Tovim. I am the person behind machinemusic.net and its many social media iterations that are required by modern life. I'd like to right off the bat thank my wonderful Patreon patrons for now enabling me to do this podcast. If that is a good thing, you'll be the judge. If you want to do that as well, support the podcast, support the site, support whatever. Just throw money at me. Go to patreon.com/machinemusic. You get exclusive stuff. We got some new, very, very cool shit coming up right now, very soon. And get exclusive recommendations, etc. Okay. So, if this is your first time listening to the podcast, I'd suggest you go back to the first episode since this is going to be kind of sequential. I introduced myself last time. I'll do it in short this time, I guess, again. My name is Ron Ben-Tovim, as I said. I am a, I've been writing the machinemusic.net blog focusing on underground, artistic, you should say extreme music, focusing on metal specifically, for the last 10 years. I'm also a PhD in English literature, focusing on post-traumatic literature, war writing, soldier writing, a lot of really sad, depressing stuff, and theory. And one of the things that has happened to me in kind of my recent years, and where actually pretty much since I finished my PhD, now that I think of it, music writing has been taking up more of my, say, intellectual space as time went by. And that process, slow at first, culminated in a series of interviews that I called the Albums of the Decade series, where I felt I wanted to just interview people, my favorite artists, about what were and are my favorite albums of theirs. And being the person that I am, those turned out to be quite, you know, unique conversations that bordered on sometimes philosophical, psychological, or aesthetical analyses of their work. And the more I did that, and it just now just dawned on me, actually recently, before recording this, that when you're in academia, and you're academic, and you analyze, you know, whatever, poetry, you don't get to interview the artist more often than not. I myself chose a field that is contemporary, so my field of expertise is contemporary American and British soldier poetry. So a lot of the people I write about are alive, and yet I don't interview them as well, because there's a kind of taboo on interviewing, on any kind of personal connection with the author or with the artist, as if that's not true analysis. And I can completely see that. There's a very large and extensive shadow or cloud of suspicion in academic circles against anything that would, you know, bear the whiff of some kind of cult of personality or inserting biography into analysis, at least in some circles. I shouldn't say that's as a blanket statement. But there is a kind of devaluement, if that's a word. Is that a word? Of personal contact with the author and with the artist. The assumption is that true analysis is of the work. And nothing that you can't figure out from the work is of value if it comes from, say, a letter or an interview with the artist. And so I found myself in a very unique position where all those, you know, preconceptions were in the wind because I wasn't doing what I was considering to be academic work. I was being a fan, basically. But I was being a fan in a quite an academic way. I think that's a safe way to describe that. And so what happened was, a lot of the questions I've always been wondering about in terms of just art in general, literature, my own writing, I'm a writer as well, I kind of had the opportunity to kind of hash those out with artists who are living, very much living. It would be horrible interviews if they weren't. And a lot of new insights came out of those, including some insights that returned and made their way back into my academic work. And so this podcast, as I explained last time, is supposed or is meant to be a continuation of that first motivation, but not to repeat it. Just like I said last time, this is not a music podcast, and by way of, I'm not going to, you know, rate things here or review. I'm not going to recommend to a large extent. Sorry. You can do that on my website, whatever, or don't, or on other people's websites. And so the interviews weren't that, and this podcast won't be the interviews. I'll include interviews. I'll include clippings of interviews. I did that last time. I might do it this time as well. But that's not the point. The point is to take that, you know, raw material the interviews afforded me and try to distill some kind of more abstract discussion of art in terms of metal and extreme music and hardcore and noise and so on. So that's my general aim. And like I said last time, every few episodes will focus on one concept, and the concept that we're in right now is authenticity. Last time, I gave a general introduction about what it is that appeals to me about authenticity, what kind of role authenticity I think has in metal and hardcore and other scenes where, you know, being real is a big part of the sociology of the scene, but also what feels real is a very big, important, big and important part of the music. Music that seems fake isn't really what a lot of people seek, I feel, in metal and hardcore, so at least it's a very important concept, even unconsciously, in those scenes. And so I wanted to start there. And last time, the snippets I gave you were from my conversations, past conversations with Aaron Weaver of Wolves in the Throne Room and Greg Anderson of Sun, Goatsnake, Southern Lord, etc., which focused on this idea of where do they see authenticity or the importance of authenticity in producing and evaluating music. Because, you know, Aaron makes music and so does Greg, but Greg also evaluates music because he gets to decide what band or what album gets included in the Southern Lord catalog, right? And so for Aaron, authenticity, like we said last time, was something that revolved around an authentic story, right? Less about whether or not you wear corpse paint to bed, and less about whether or not you speak with the spirits first thing in the morning. So less biography, less who you are as an artist, as a person, compared to what you produce as an artist, and more what it is that you produce. And interestingly, for Aaron, I think maybe I'm latching on to his wording, but, you know, that's what I do. It's your story, right? So whatever it is you fabricated, whatever story, made up narrative, is who you are, is what you attempt to produce as an artist. So that is it's an interesting kind of cleaving or separation between the artist and the artwork, but not in the same way that we would expect, right? That usually that separation is, I'm an artist. That means that my personal life is uninteresting by way of interpreting my work. But what Aaron was saying, that I'm a story. There is no real me. It's a bottomless well. There's no bedrock. And if I am a story, an authentic work of art would be one that would try to convey that story or produce that story or do something with that story. So that's one aspect of authenticity. I thought that was, I just have to say that I chose a concept, very interesting, a lot of words, but it's just horrible to say. Authenticity. Anyway, and the second clipping with Greg was more kind of geared at how does he evaluate real music, or what role does real, the concept of real or authentic, I think they're interchangeable, have in the bands he chooses for the label. And what he said was music that seemed unreal or fake or not authentic is more often than not the music that he chooses not to include on his label. And so I think it's safe to say that it's closer, what Greg is saying is closer to what fans feel like, maybe unconsciously, when they choose their favorite artists or albums or songs, right? If it isn't it, whatever it is, then it isn't. I know for a fact that's something I think about every day. You know, I go through, I should say plow through, really large amounts of music every day to try to get to the music I'm interested to write about or recommend or whatever. And I know quite quickly where if it's going to be what I think it is. So, and it's a personal choice, right? But whatever it is I am personally looking for, when it isn't there, it's very apparent. And I wonder, and this is a question that I may answer, may not, whether that has anything to do with reality. And so last time, one of the things I also mentioned, which is one of the things I'd like to expand on today, was that this idea that metal and hardcore and noise and all the underground extreme forms of music that are kind of associated within that family are not just casually connected to these ideas of authenticity and realness and this anchored feel, but are in fact genres that were formed by people who were looking for that and are populated or supported by fans and listeners who are looking for that. Which means that in some ways, there's this kind of grand narrative that involves fakeness in society, a lack of sincerity, whether that is from coming from a strictly religious household and you feel it's fake, or from an overly commercialized society when you feel everything's fake and everyone's being fake. And then sometimes you just bump against, you go to a show, a friend told you, you listen to a song, and it hits you how unfake that feels. Often, interestingly, involving pain and anger, which may be something we'll get to. Maybe this episode, maybe later. This idea that something that it is angry, someone who is so angry, his voice, his throat is literally kind of like leaping from his mouth, feels like it's real. And if it feels like it's real, then it must be. Perhaps this is why a lot of kind of gatekeeping is a part of these scenes as well, because, you know, it's like a reservoir or like the sacred. There's a very famous early 20th century poet by the name of T.S. Eliot who wrote a very famous early 20th century literary essay called The Sacred Wood. Is it a book? It's a book. This idea that art is a sacred wood that can't be treated using the same tools we use to kind of analyze anything else in life. And so this sacred place for metalheads or for punks that is sacred to an extent because they feel it's real. And the friends they make there are real by proxy to the real that is the music. And so what I'm trying to say in this weird tangent is that real matters. And in a way that may be kind of characteristic of who I am, my way of trying to gauge what real is not to stick my finger at it and say, oh yeah, I felt that, that's real. Because that would be hard to do with music, which is a mediated art form, you know, usually not. Even if it is performative, you listen to it in a non-performative setting a lot. So touching your player, that sounded creepy just now, sorry about that, is not the way to gauge reality, right? Whatever it is that is making you feel real is something else. And so I'd like to expand on those aspects of metal that are reality-inducing. And I'd like to do that in a very convoluted way. So this is the opposite of pointing a finger at something, even though it kind of involves that, as you'll see. One of my main theoretical tools that has helped me really, more than anything, think about reality in terms of art, which is a very sketchy border. How can you speak of reality in terms of something that is fake? It's a big question, right? I can't answer it, but I've always been interested by that tension. And so one of the people that has really helped me, and that I wish I could interview, but has been dead for quite a while, is an American philosopher and semiotician, semiotics, which is a study of systems of signs, or like languages, but not, you know, limited to languages, is Charles Peirce, who is, I'm guessing, someone you have never heard of. And he is kind of like everyone has a pet band, he's my pet philosopher. And the reason Peirce is as interesting to me as he is, because one of the ways in which he analyzes systems of signs, and again, systems of signs is any kind of family grouping of things that mean other things, right? One example that would be language, right? The word apple, whether written out or said, is a thing. But when we say apple, we don't mean just the word. We mean something else. So you're using something to say, to point, if you will, and here comes the finger, to point at something else. Another one of those cliched examples would be stop signs or traffic signs in general, right? If you are unaware that a palm, white palm in a red circle or hexagram, whatever, means stopping, you would just drive and maybe cause an accident. But knowing the system of signs that that is a part of, you know that that hand means stop. So there are many sign systems, some of them more clear and more kind of upfront than others. Interestingly, if you want to look into that, semiotics also deals with, you know, the language of movies, for instance. What does it mean when someone coughs in a movie? That usually means they're going to die. What does it mean in movie language when someone is glowing, etc., etc., right? And so Peirce is looking at all those systems. Peirce, I should say. It's a common mistake and I hate it. Peirce is looking at all these systems and saying all these have three kinds of signs. Now bear with me. It sounds boring, but trust me, it is. And those three are icon, symbol, and index. And all that kind of division is according to the sign's relationship to the thing it is pointing toward. So an icon, that's easiest, much like an icon that you know of from your personal life, say the icon you press on your smartphone when you want to call someone, right? So that icon looks like a phone because what you're about to do is call someone. And so it stands for something by being similar to it. Another example of an icon would be a portrait, right? If someone takes a relatively accurate portrait of you, or takes your picture for that matter, that is an iconic symbol of you. And the reason it symbolizes you is because it looks like you. It's familiar. They're kind of similar to one another. In music, and this is where it gets a little sketchy, this would be any time music is imitating something or is gesturing towards something by being like it. So if you've ever been read Peter and the Wolf when you were a child and as a result were terrified for the remainder of your adult life, like I was, you'd know that musical instruments are made to sound like, or at least kind of approximate the sound of animals. So the flute is that, whatever, I hate that shit. Nightmares, I don't want to talk about it. So if a musical instrument is quoting, trying to sound like a bird, I think in terms of, say, grindcore maybe, use of samples, right? Use of movie samples. When someone is sampling The Exorcist, they're not just saying, you know, this is a movie. They're saying, oh, Exorcist, think The Exorcist. Why would you think of The Exorcist? Oh, yeah, because The Exorcist is literally there. Right? So that's an icon. Second kind is a symbol. Symbol doesn't have to look like the thing it represents. In fact, it often never does look like, otherwise it would be an icon, right? A symbol is kind of like a general community consensus that whatever it is this word means is what it means, such as the word apple. May have been a time where apple was an iconic word because it imitated, for instance, I don't know, the sound of fucking apple dropping on someone's head. Maybe. But that, whatever that connection, if that ever was a connection, I just made that up, it is lost. And the only reason we call those round, multicolored fruit stuffs apple is because we were taught that that's the word you use. No other reason. And because everyone was taught that that's the word you use, then that's the word you use. It's a common agreement that this is a word that has meaning, and everyone agrees that that's the meaning. In music, symbols are kind of tricky. Again, all these things are tricky when you supplant them to music, because music isn't necessarily a language that way, in the way that sign systems are. But I'm trying. Give me a break. And so a symbol in music would be something like melody, because melody is a language. And certain chord progressions have been ingrained into our kind of public consciousness as listeners or as a culture that we identify them as music. Now, this isn't meaning per se, not in the same way that a word means something, but it does communicate, I think, it does communicate a certain being within a system, right? We all agree that this nice minor chord sounds lovely after that nice, lovely minor chord. Not often in metal music and abrasive underground music do we have melody as a pretty element, right? Often, I think metal is interested in destroying melody or upending it, doing something interesting with it, right? Otherwise, it would be pop. And pop, as we all know, is the, you know, the forbidden other of metal music. I'm kidding, obviously. I don't think that, you know, but that's, yeah, you know what I'm saying. And so melody communicates, even if it doesn't communicate, say, a specific meaning, it does communicate us being part of the same system, which in a same, in a kind of a way, that's what a symbol does, right? I say a word that really means nothing. You accept that word as what I mean it to be, and we kind of function as a society. It works. Icon, symbol. Now, the third one is the one that I'm really interested in and will be the focus of what I'm trying to do today is index. And I think it's safe to say that index is very important for a lot of the modes of music that you and I find appealing and have spent our lives listening to. Which is, index is kind of in a kind of a footprint of reality in language or in a sign system. It means that reality is stepping on your language. It's not indicating reality. Your sign is not saying, hey, I'll say this weird combination of syllables and you'll know what I mean, right? Right, right, wink, wink. It's not saying, you know, I'm like this because I'm similar. It's saying reality. I know this is very confusing. We'll use easier examples and we're kind of trickle our way. Is again, not an idiom that's probably used by anyone but me right now, but fuck it. It'll trickle our way into music. Thermometers are indexical in that when we use an old school mercury or whatever thermometer, the metal actually heats, liquid metal, right? Actually heats and rises to the point where we see, say, 100 degrees Fahrenheit or 37 or 38 degrees Celsius, right? So it isn't saying to us it's 38 by similarity. It isn't explaining to us using a word we all accept that it is this degree. It is showing us that the physical reality of the instrument is such that this is the reality. Another example would be a footprint. If you see a footprint in the sand or in the ground or in the mud, what that means is someone walked here. You're not told that someone walked there. The fact that someone walked there is not communicated to you in a complex way. It's just evident that someone walked there because there is a foot. Now, we can fake that. I can just take a shoe and, you know, imprint it all around and make people confused, right? But basically, our experience has led us to believe that if we see that, it means this. One of the great examples is smoke, right? Smoke means fire. Smoke is a physical product of fire. It's not a communicative element, right? Okay, so enough of those. In language, it's usually words, indices, I should say, are words that anchor a general statement into a very specific time and place, which means, I think, in layman's terms, it makes it real, right? So words like it, then, that, here, now, I, all the words that take like a general statement about the world is a beautiful place, and I'm not afraid to die. I can't believe I just said that, right? Actually, that's a great example. The world is a beautiful place is a general statement, and I am not afraid to die. Makes it into an individual statement made by an individual person, although unspecified, which is interesting, but we'll get to that maybe later, probably never. So an index is what takes whatever part of language that is abstract, general, it makes it real, or makes it individual, tied to a time and a place. Now, one of the things that I find most interesting about metal music is that it often, the appeal, or at least one appeal of its reality, or the reality that I am assuming here it has, or the effect it has, through disruption of communication. And in a way, indices, disrupt communication as well. They enable it, because if I was just talking and there would be no I, it, here, it'd be just general, it would be very hard to get your point across. You need those anchors to make it into a vivid, effective means of communication. But in a way, they are disruptive. And in certain forms of music, of art, disruption becomes the focus almost as equally as does communication. And I'm assuming, and this is maybe a false assumption, that music is a form of communication. Someone is trying to say something through music, or the lyrics, or them together, the instrumentation, the production, with the hopes that someone will get that message. With the likelihood that they won't, right? Because remember when we talked about what Aaron Weaver said, that once the message is out there, it's not his anymore. It's whatever interaction the listener has with it. That means that whatever intention the author had or the artist had is lost almost upon the moment of producing the work of art. So it's a failed attempt at communication, if you will. But it is intended as a means of communicating something, of actualizing something, of treating something. And so I'd like to, here at this point, present one snippet that I think is very interesting from a past interview, where I feel like what we're talking about here is reality in a specific time and place. And here, this is from my interview with Johannes Persson, vocalist, guitarist for Cult of Luna, the Swedish post-metal band Cult of Luna. This is a recent interview, relatively speaking, from the Albums of the Decade series. And here he's talking about the album that really meant a lot to him when he was younger, which was Unbroken's Life Live Regret. And the reasons he gives for why it's an important album are interesting for me right now. And let me just play you Johannes talking about that album, and I'll get back to you in a second.
Unbroken, Life, Love, Regret. That album completely changed everything. I don't think I've listened to an album in such a religious way, neither before or since then.
What was about it?
Unbroken, Life, Love, Regret.
No, but what was...
An Unbroken cover for 7 inch years ago.
Okay.
Called Recluse.
Yeah.
It was like a metal hardcore band, but it was so, like, that album is probably one of the darkest pieces of music that ever been put to tape. It's such a, it has teen anxiety written all over it. And it was perfect at at the time when I got into the music, like all the teenage anxiety that I could relate to with, you know, dealing with world problems with a teenage mind and also like with mental health issues and all that. I mean, it was, and probably with the heaviest piece of music that can still be labeled as hardcore, it was perfect for me.
So you were attracted to the fact that some of these songs were abrasive or heavy, or
they were heavy. I mean, they were heavier than anything that I've heard before in the hardcore scene which I was involved in back then. It was heavy, fast, and honest, and one of the like sloppiest recorded albums ever. No, I wouldn't say that because there's a lot of sloppy records out there. But it was so honest and genuine, and that really was something that attracted. It was very attractive at that point. It felt like it was written, like both the lyrics and the music was written straight from the heart.
And is that something you still look for? I mean, even for the bands you like to listen to, still, is that something you still look out for? That yeah. Sense of something that's honest.
Yeah, but I mean, what I don't think to be quite honest, even the most music, I think everyone that are involved in it would describe it as honest. I don't think that's, I mean, it's an abstract term that
yeah.
really can mean anything.
Yeah. So I can ask you, so I guess I can ask you what it means for you.
I don't know. It's hard to explain when you're just relating to a feeling.
Yeah.
And something like, it's something that I can relate to. Whether or not it's a, like, if I interpret the record correctly or not, but it's all about basically a gut feeling.
Yeah.
Which you also could say, you can boil down, do I think it's good or not?
Yeah.
But for me, and for me, there are certain elements that I'm attracted to when it comes to music, and I heard a song yesterday, I can't remember, somebody posted it just online, and I really loved it. It was so dirty and super dark, and it felt like it was recorded in a basement with shitty equipment. sorry, I can't remember the artist or the song. Just that it really, I really liked it, and it was for the first time in a while that I actually liked new music.
Hmm.
I like a lot of music, but it was something that really related to me in a way not many bands do.
And we're back to present day Ron, not sometime mid-2019. All right. So there's a lot to unpack there in terms of what I've already discussed, right? What he found arresting about that album was that it felt emotional. He used the word heavy, which is related to what we're talking about right now. But he also kind of almost quoted, in a way, the equipment and setting in which that album was recorded, and also that other band he couldn't remember the name of. The reason behind both of those is an identifiability that has to do with specific time and place. Unbroken are emotionally unstable, exposed, heavy. Only they can be what they are right now. That other band he can't remember that had shitty equipment in the basement, he loved the fact that it was shitty equipment in the basement because it allowed the setting to be clear and allowed a specific setting that I think he identifies with to be clear. And the kind of music, this is one of the cliches that said about, you know, early black metal, that it sounds like it's all, you know, transistor radio recordings of shit, right? But really what those artists are trying to do is foreground, emphasize setting, emphasize mediation. They're not saying I'm trying to record this in the best possible way for it to, you know, this pristine music to arrive at your ears. They're saying, notice the fact that we are using stringed instruments wrong, right? We're strumming them. The overdrive is weird, or the distortion is weird. Our growling is different than what you're used to, say, from a death metal growling. Everything is so out there that one of the things you notice is not just the melody or the riffs or the progressions or the technicality, but the fact that they're using things to do things. That, to me, is the indexical aspect of metal and music in general. One that I often associate with the drums, right? Because if there's anything that anchors a general musical statement to a specific place, to me, it's always the drums, right? It's like one of the reasons that the drums are one of the earliest forms or instruments, musical instruments, one of the earliest forms of both music and communication is because they're very, I'm here. This is happening, right? That guitarist, he's kind of going to that shredding solo. You might as well be in Mars. That dude singing thinks he's, you know, an angel, so you think you're in heaven. But the drummer is always going to be, at least for the most part, there are exclusions, you know, exceptions to this rule that are very interesting, and we'll get to those actually very soon. The drummer is the here, now, which is the index. What metal does, which was kind of not done before that, is use that kind of intuition of emphasizing the person using, emphasizing setting, and emphasizing the thingness of the instruments through exaggerating them. One of the ways in which that happens is through growling. Another way is distortion. Now, why is growling and distortion indexical in this cockamamie thing I'm talking about right now? Because when someone growls, he's not just not singing. And also, he's not just singing poorly. So it means the effect isn't of someone who doesn't know how to sing, although that is part of the effect. And the effect isn't just I'm singing out of tune, although that is maybe at some points part of the effect. The effect is, this is my fucking throat. I am using my throat. Now, this should not be a surprise to you. Celine Dion uses her throat, right? Celine Dion and Mariah Carey use their throat. You have to use your throat to speak, to sing, to do whatever with your voice. But a metal singer growling is saying, you are noticing me use my throat. You can actually hear my throat. When a guitarist turns whatever, you know, clean channel they have into overdrive, that used to mean you're doing it wrong, not in terms of guitar playing, but in terms of, you know, production of recording. You're going over the bar, you know, the guitar is going crazy. That means that the pure musical expression that is supposed to arrive at the ears of the pure naive listener is being disrupted by the listener saying, oh, why am I hearing whatever went wrong in the studio? I want to hear something that is beyond the studio. And here comes metal and says, huh, that wrong thing is right for me. And again, not all metal, not all the time. Clean passages and clean singing are all allowed. I'm not being, you know, exclusionary here. What I am saying is that these elements are very important in a lot of extreme metal because they emphasize the thing doing the work. And by emphasizing them, disrupt the communication. Part of the joy, part of the thrill you feel when you're listening to metal and you're saying to yourself, yes, this feels real, is the fact that you're not getting perfection. You're getting someone who is flawed, which I should say is the reason I hate certain growls. And this is a personal preference, not a slight against anyone. I hate what has become to be known as groove metal growls. I really don't like the growls from, say, 2000-ish onwards on bands like Meshuggah because they sound even. They sound professional. They sound well done. It's as if you took something that was meant to be disruptive and ugly and made it into an art form in and of itself, and thus, in a way, kind of missing the point. I'm sure that Randy Blythe has a wonderful range and is a very expressive singer and the deliverer of words and lyrics, but his voice sounds professional to me, and thus, I kind of tune out. It's boring. I'm not interested. Now, one of the things that this brought to mind when I was thinking about this was modernist art, and more specifically, abstract expressionism and the New York School of Abstract Expressionism, people like Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko, and a growing school in the beginning of the 20th century of people who are not just trying to paint. We can actually get earlier than that, right? People used to try to paint people and things realistically, or beautifully, at least symbolically. And sometime around the 19th century, or kind of turn of the 19th century into the 20th century with Impressionism, that becomes less the idea, and what becomes more of an important aspect is the artist, right? So when Van Gogh looks at something and says, yeah, there's a wheat field, but that's not how I see it, then he is beginning to be a bigger part of how you see the picture. By the time when you get to a complete abstraction, that is completely almost only the artist, right? There's no figuration. There's no attempt to show you things. There's just, you know, compositional ideas being thought out, conceptual ideas being thought out, stuff. And one of the interesting things about that is that it brings to the foreground, or it emphasizes the things that are being used in order to make art. When you look at a marvelous Michelangelo masterpiece, you're not necessarily thinking about the paint. You're thinking about, that's beautiful. I feel I can walk into that. When you're looking at a Rothko, or when you're looking at a piece of modernist art that has like a thick layer of paint, monochromatic, it doesn't make any sense. One of the things you're thinking about is, look at that paint. Look at all that paint. You might be thinking this guy has no talent in using that paint, but you're dealing with the medium as well. There's an attempt to disrupt your joy, unmediated joy of just looking at something pretty and remind you that someone made this. Now, that disruption is discussed by kind of one of the more eminent critics of 20th century art, a man called Clement Greenberg, who I'm not going to introduce at length, but he's a very interesting person. If you want to read about him, read about him. But in 1961, he published a book called Art and Culture, and in it, there's this quote about what he calls polyphonic all-over painting, which he means in a way, painting doesn't have a definite center. If you look at a Jackson Pollock, there isn't one point your eyes goes to. Your eye goes to the whole thing. So it's an all-over painting, what he's calling, right? And so this is what he has to say. This is a quote from Art and Culture. The very notion of uniformity is anti-aesthetic. Yet many all-over pictures seem to succeed precisely by virtue of their uniformity, their sheer monotony. The dissolution of the pictorial into sheer texture, into apparently sheer sensation, into the accumulation of repetitions, seems to speak for and answer something profound in contemporary sensibility. End quote. What Greenberg is saying, basically, is that this is not supposed to work. This is repetitious. It's monotonous. There is no center of gravity your eyes just goes to, right? And yet somehow, because of these things, it succeeds in doing something different, right? Into the accumulation of repetitions, into sheer texture. When he says sheer texture, I don't think he actually means sheer texture, but let's say exaggerated emphasis on texture. I hear Chuck Schuldiner growling. Or I hear, you know, a Gene Hoglan drum fill. Or I hear, you know, Samael, Ceremony of Opposites, one of my favorite all-time metal albums. That guitar tone to me is the epitome of metal guitar. That is sheer texture. when you hear that guitar, you're not thinking to yourself, wow, I wonder how he learned the technique to play that way. Oh, I wonder where that melody is taking me. One of the things you're hearing is texture. I mean, I guess maybe there's like an engineer somewhere out there that can explain to me that distortion is actually waves, you know, fucking up something in the amp or something. But what you're hear is sound waves doing something, and you can hear them doing it. And in a way, that disruption of enjoyment, of kind of a simple saccharine enjoyment, is in itself real. Now, I should say, as a caveat, since we're already kind of knee-deep into theory here, that Clement Greenberg is a Marxist critic. And Marxism has, whether you know it or not, is what's called historical materialism, meaning that materiality is what determines reality, not what is being said, but what is actually the conditions, your material condition. So if you are born on a certain street in a certain neighborhood, that shapes your life much more than anything else that's, you know, theoretical about your life. So material conditions create reality and change over time, so historical. And so for Greenberg, it's important that the material is coming out of the woodwork, so to speak, in visual art. The material is saying, all this fake shit that you've been fed up until now, it's over. It's time to face what's real. And what's real is, for instance, labor. Someone had to work for this painting. This is the paint he used. This paint cost money. All the material conditions say of the painting. And so when Greenberg says the sheer texture is bringing something that is, how he said it, profound in contemporary sensibility, he's talking about, you know, capitalism, right? He's talking about how capitalism, and this is kind of one of the kind of tropes of Marxist theory, that capitalism is an ever-insistent attempt to weave an illusion that makes you forget about reality. And that good art in Marxist ideas is the kind of art that makes you see reality for what it is. And so I'm saying all this that Greenberg is not just by accident focusing on this element of the art world or of artistic production. There is an ideology at work here. But I guess I'm also saying this also to say that that does not have to be the ideology. You don't have to be a Marxist, in other words, in order to kind of appreciate the reality-inducing aspects of art. Where I and Clement Greenberg don't seem to agree, and obviously I'm putting myself on par with one of the most influential and important art critics of the 20th century, is that for me, reality is an effect, not actual reality. And that when I hear an Inter Arma riff, or when I hear Lingua Ignota scream in what seems to be like pain, I'm enjoying that, but I'm also asking, how do they do that? I'm interested in it as an aesthetical experience, not as something that actually discloses the reality of the oppression of the proletariat, and so on and so forth. And I think the way I'd like to close this episode is kind of try to do a kind of composite of everything that we've talked about up until now. Peirce talking about the index that anchors communication, doesn't really communicate as much. It does communicate a bit, but doesn't communicate as much as it anchors it into a time and a place and a person. And what Greenberg said about how putting emphasis on texture and on the medium is a new kind of artistic success. In a way, you could say that Jackson Pollock was, you know, to painting what, you know, Tomi Iommi was to rock, right? That what Tomi Iommi did was play rock, but in a way that emphasizes whatever it is that it's actually happening when you play rock, the distorted, whatever, Ozzy's weird voice, all these things, right? So I'd like to take all of these together and do like a short, very short analysis, because I've already talked way over my limit to myself, arbitrary limit, I should say, using a work of modernist metal. And the work I've chosen is the second song, I should say, on the debut album by Sumac, which is the band formed by former ISIS in current and contemporary and always Omag Gloom frontman Aaron Turner, Brian Cook of such luminary bands such as Russian Circles, Botch, you know the guy, and Nick Yakishin, who is a drummer for Baptists. This is the debut, this is the first album. I find the opening to the song very interesting in these terms. So let's hear the first part of whatever it is that I mean, and we'll talk a bit and we'll get to the next one. So, given that metal by 2015 is already a language, when it first sprung in the 70s and 80s, it wasn't, and everything, a lot of the things that were done were new, as those first iterations turned into thrash and death metal, it starts to kind of broaden, right? It, this first impetus, distortion by itself, is not that important anymore. You get speed, you get political consciousness, for instance, or whatever. You get punk influences. You get the growling. So more and more disruption is needed into the kind of system for it to function as the disruptive indexical thing that we were talking about before. By 2015, this is all cliche. You can't really make a metal album in the way that we're talking about or have talked about right now, because the growling has been done. All forms of growling has been done, you know. Everything's been done. And in a way, Aaron Turner in 2015 and Brian Cook and Nick Yakishin find themselves in the same kind of problem Jackson Pollock may have been, you know, may have faced, right? How do I paint? Everything's been painted. And yet what I feel should be painted is something about pain, something about personhood, something about disruption. How do I disrupt if everything is already disrupted, right? If I'm Jackson Pollock, right? How can I disrupt painting more than Van Gogh or Monet? How can I do that? And in a way, what the first part of this song is doing, that riff is a wonderful explanation. In a way, a borrow from modernist music, you know, people like Schoenberg or Stravinsky, and saying, I'm not going anywhere. So first message to you, listener, this is not a progression. This is not a chord progression. What you're getting is repetition. You're getting that eerie sample of that kind of chord, double chord on the piano being played on a loop that's cut very severely, right? You can hear it's a loop. You can hear it's not the same guy going or a woman going bam, 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 all, you know, repeatedly. You hear it's a looped one chord. And so the introduction into the song is the guitar is not going to give you melody in this song. The guitar is going to give you a platter of paint. It's as if Aaron Turner took the riff spatula and spread a thick layer of monochromatic paint and said, no, I'm not going to paint a person. This is not going to be a tree. This is going to be just a slathering of distortion and sounds. And the only thing, because it's repetitious, the only thing you'll be able to do while you're listening to this slathering of distortion and sound is the guitar, a distorted guitar, and how weird it sounds, and all the weird ranges it has. It's almost like looking at a painting and saying, like, only this is so boring, so monochromatic, I can only think about the paint. This is Aaron Turner's think about the paint moment. Now, what's interesting about that is that it sets up an atmosphere, a context, in which the drums, which are usually those that perform that function, the drums as the great index provider, right? The drums that are saying, this is human, this is now, this is here. The drums are out of a job because Aaron Turner stole their job. Aaron Turner stole the repetitious, not a story, not a melody job from the drum. And so what Nick Yakishin does brilliantly, and this is what makes this section as affecting, I think, as it does, is that he plays the role with the percussion of order, melody, of communication in the song. In other words, Nick Yakishin, his hands, his feet, are telling you it's okay. This is actually a song, don't worry. We're getting somewhere. All right, let's listen to that part. How great was fucking that? How amazing was that? Right? I'm sorry. Just fanning out. All right. Is fanning out a concept? I don't think so. Anyway, what Yakishin is doing here is humanizing the very dead, mechanic, inanimate thing that is the guitars. Because Sumac is not Stravinsky. As influenced as they may be in, you know, modernist techniques and things like that, they're not just trying to freak you out for a full hour and kind of cause you discomfort in just hurling non-communicative things at you. They're actually interested in writing songs, but they're writing songs that are very influenced by that, I think, this is my intuition, right? By that motivation of disruption. And so the role reversal causes that. Yakishin is the one that is soothing you into the song. And spoiler alert, this song doesn't get anywhere. It has sections, right? If you listen to it by your own, whatever. It doesn't, you know, ascend. There's no crescendo. One of the interesting things about it also vocally is that Aaron Turner is not using his hardcore voice. If you listen to Isis, even Old Man Gloom, there's a much more emotional range in his vocal performance in those, you know, settings. In Sumac, at least in this album, he is pure texture, just like that Clement Greenman quote, right? Sheer texture. All he is throat. I am a throat. That's it. He's not even a human being. He's just an organ performing a function that is as repetitive as what the guitars are doing, right? So the rhythm section, again, this is just, to me, this is brilliant. Brian Cook and Nick Yakishin's job becomes to be the human beings in the song that is completely devoid of, you know, any kind of comforting melody, symbolic or iconic. There's no attempt to imitate anything. There's no attempt to kind of convey communicative attempt, you know, sweet melodies, nothing. And so the rhythm section, the heartbeat of everything, is what's left to do the job of communicating. Now, this to me is what metal had to do at that point. But before that, metal could have done that, or could have gotten away with doing that with way less. And actually, I should say, way less thought. You know, I love Repulsion. Repulsion, Horrified, all-time great album. Not sure how much thought went into that other than I want to fuck shit up. And not sure that people at the time were interested in anything other than, I'd like to listen to a person fuck shit up, because fucking shit up is what makes it real to me. By 2015, a different kind of attempt is required to fuck shit up, right? That is not working anymore. This is what's now. Now, I think this is enough for now. I had more stuff I had on my mind, but I feel like I need to leave myself wanting more, and maybe in that way, maybe leaving you wanting more, although I can't imagine why. And I actually don't know what I'll do next time. I think next time, I said at the beginning, at the last part of last episode, that I'll do something about counter authenticity. But I think there's still a lot of stuff to mine out of this authenticity mine, if you will. And so maybe we'll stay here for a while before I feel like I want to move into the counter reaction to that. That's it for now. Seeing that I've already used the Sumac song, might as well stick at the end of this because it's a lovely song. And maybe when you hear it, you'll have more things to say or comment. Be sure to follow us, me, Facebook, Machine Music, Instagram, Machine Music 1981, Spotify, Machine Music, Patreon, Machine Music, whoever wants to hurl huge amounts of cash at me, feel free to do so, and see you next time.